Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. There's nothing that makes for a great gathering like a communal table. In the Louisiana springtime, that means huge pots of crawfish poured onto newspaper-covered tables, then peeled and eaten while still steaming hot. This week, crawfish historian Sam Irwin tells the story of how the lowly mudbug grew into a vital part of Louisiana's economy. Louisiana crawfish are seasonal, but in the South, barbecue knows no season. We'll move from the crawfish pot to the smoker and talk barbecue with Southern Foodways founder John T. Edge and Drew Robinson of Jim and Nick's Barbecue. We're heading straight from the pot right into the fire on this week's Louisiana Eats. Crawfish have been part of Louisiana's diet for centuries, but it wasn't until communities along the Atchafalaya Basin began selling them commercially that our little mudbug became a worldwide industry. That industry is now worth more than $200 million annually, and crawfish are synonymous with our state, especially in southwest Louisiana. Sam Irwin's new book tells the story of how our freshwater crustacean became a powerful ally to Louisiana rice farmers, as well as a welcome guest at springtime gatherings across the state. What part did the founding of the Brobridge Crawfish Festival in 1959 play in mainstreaming the mudbug?
Well, up until then, the market was just being developed. And really, I kind of thought it might have developed earlier, except for World War II.
Ah.
But in the 50s, Shep Morrison, he called Brobridge the crawfish capital in a speech in French that he made in St. Martin Parish. So people started calling St. Martin Parish crawfish country. And when it was time for the centennial celebration, it was a pretty good hook, and I think it was a pretty brilliant move to pick the crawfish as a symbol.
So people started coming from all over the place. So many interesting things go on in the crawfish industry between 1959 and 1960, because it was right around that time that Lester Guidry had the first crawfish pond, which they've ended up being called farms. Tell us about him and his crawfish pond.
Okay, well, Lester Tétain Guidry, everybody called him Tétain. I think he really started fooling with a pond in the 40s as people began to develop the market. His son, Kirby Guidry, who was my orthodontist years ago, told me that his father was not educated, but he was a natural biologist. He could identify about 20 different species of crawfish there. He was just a hardworking man and saw that people were starting to buy crawfish, at least in the St. Martin Parish, Lafayette Parish area. And he built some banks, and he let his pond get flooded. And I'm told that that first day when he opened it for people to go in and crawfish, that they caught 16,000 pounds of crawfish.
16,000 pounds in one day?
I was told he had to stop it for fear that maybe they might catch all of the crawfish.
That's incredible. And am I correct that the crawfish has, in essence, saved a lot of Louisiana rice farmers?
I'm not sure if saved is the correct word, but in 1966, LSU hired Jim Avalt to come in and start its aquaculture program. And everybody thought at that time catfish pond would be the thing. But actually, people from St. Martin Parish along the basin, they said, we want to know how to grow crawfish in ponds because we've got a market that we can sell to. And they gave recommendations on how much water to pump into a pond, what stocking rate would you add crawfish to it, gave them recommendations on that. And pretty much from 1966 to 1980, they had that part down pretty good. they said, this is how you can raise crawfish. You pump water in a pond and pretty much let the mama crawfish do the rest, but you pump water at a certain time and she'll make you some crawfish.
To think all of this has come about, $200 million in crawfish business in just really about 50 years, huh?
It's amazing. It's incredible. And it's all because people are crazy for crawfish, I think.
So I'm very interested in how the crawfish industry develops with the peeling operations. And it was actually a gentleman named Abby
Lachelet.
Thank you for pronouncing that one. In Catahoula,
yeah,
in 1949, who got the first permit to peel crawfish for sale for retail and restaurant consumption. So how did this permitting situation come about?
Well, first off, Poppy, Lachelet is a well-respected family name on the western side of the basin. I think there was a lot of crawfish peeling going on, and I think he was maybe the first simply, shucks, we're starting to sell tail meat. We better make sure that we're following whatever rules because, you know, you hate for the law to come in and impose something on you. Abby went to the Board of Health and asked for them, what are your rules and regulations? And they didn't have any. They had to develop them. In the 50s and 60s, people moved out of the basin and into the communities like Henderson. And really, the mothers, the wives, they helped their husbands. Crawfish peeling was a source of income for them, and they could add money to the family.
So there still is no crawfish peeling machine, huh? This is all handwork.
It's all handwork. The Louisiana Crawfish Research and Promotion Board is trying to develop a peeling machine, but I came across an article from the Advocate in which Lionel Hayes, who was my grandfather's foreman, is talking about a crawfish peeling machine. And we still don't have one.
All these years, all that money,
Some of it is we like the crawfish fat. And how do you make a machine that's going to preserve the crawfish fat?
That's absolutely true. And Chinese crawfish make up 90% of the world's crawfish sales. Why?
There's just a lot of labor there. We grow about 100 million pounds of crawfish, and that's pretty impressive mm-hmm. when you consider that in 1959, we only had maybe about 2 million pounds of crawfish. But the Chinese are growing 1 billion pounds of crawfish. Well, now they're testing Chinese tail meat in the Chinese supermarkets. People in China have mostly eaten boiled crawfish. They hadn't developed a taste for tail meat. And if tail meat takes off in China, there might not be too much coming here.
Well, that'd be good, yes, if the Chinese get really hungry for their own crawfish. Thank you, Sam, so much for coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Oh, Poppy, it was great to be here.
Sam Irwin, author of Louisiana Crawfish, A Succulent History of the Cajun Crustacean. When the topic of crawfish comes up, most people naturally think of South Louisiana because, after all, that little Cajun bayou town of Brobridge, located south of I-10, is the self-proclaimed crawfish capital of the world. But that said, watch out, Brobridge. It seems the folks in North Louisiana have quite a taste for mudbugs, too. Here to tell us all about mudbug madness in Shreveport is our Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Chris Jay. Chris.
Hey, Poppy.
Hey, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Chris, how long has Shreveport's love affair with crawfish been going on?
Well, Mudbug Madness is in its 31st year in 2014, so it's been going on for quite some time. Shreveport Bossier is kind of a gateway drug of Louisiana for a lot of Texans. I hope and I believe that once they get hooked on crawfish in Festival Plaza in Shreveport, that they find their way down to Brobridge, because that's an incredible festival. One thing I love about Mudbug Madness, and I still don't know how they do this, I mean, they sell about 80,000 pounds of crawfish, but somehow they manage to keep the prices really affordable. Visitors can get like a 3-pound tray for like $8. Again, that gateway drug thing, it's first one's heavily discounted, but you're going to come back for more.
You're,
you know,
coming
what I mean?
Back for more.
But I always encourage people to explore those food vendors that are sort of surrounding the music stages in addition to the boiled crawfish. There's a woman named Lila Davis Catering that does this incredible Creole sauce piquant. There's some incredible crab and crawfish pistolettes. You know, get out there and find some of the things that in addition to the boiled crawfish.
So there's more than just crawfish.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
And are there any crawfish dishes that you all are serving up there that might have a distinct Northern Louisiana brand on it?
You know, that's an interesting question that you put it that way. One thing that I find that Mudbug Madness does is it kind of brings out of the woodwork all of these people who have ended up in North Louisiana but are from Southwest Louisiana and South Louisiana in general. So the answer to that's probably kind of no, because a lot of these vendors are from the Lafayette or Lake Charles area, and they're wanting to cook and serve things that they connect to their youth or their past. So that Creole sauce piquant, for example, I've never had it anywhere in Shreveport-Bossier other than at Mudbug Madness.
Well,
you know what
sounds,
I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds to me that it's sort of like in keeping with what I think is the number one food festival, the Jazz and Heritage Fest, because there's dishes we get at Jazz Fest that you don't get any other time but at Jazz Fest.
Right.
How many food vendors are there?
There are about 40 food vendors. It's
that's huge.
And there are two stages of music, and the food vendors kind of surround both stages. It's not all Cajun and Creole food. You can get yourself a funnel cake if you want to. I mean, definitely, it's still a Shreveport-Bossier festival, you know. You can still get a donkey tail.
What is a donkey tail?
It's just basically a sausage on a stick.
Okay, I learn something new every time I talk to you, Chris. So the boiling is going on right there on site continuously?
Yes, absolutely. And it's funny how often I see tourists kind of just surrounding the where all the boiling's happening. And it's funny because there might be a great band on stage, but the tourists are going to be surrounding like the boiling area, taking photos of the crawfish coming out in the big pots and the corn and potatoes and all that. I mean, to them, it's exotic and different.
Well, thank you so much for letting us all in on Mudbug Madness. I'm so glad to know that Brobridge doesn't hold the exclusive rights to bragging.
Absolutely. We're glad to share that tradition with Brobridge.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Poppy.
Chris J., our North Louisiana Eats roving reporter. This year's festival takes place May 22nd through the 25th. More information, including musical lineups, can be found online at mudbugmadness.com.
Now take Mr. Crawfish in your hand. He's gonna look good in your frying pan. If you fry him, Chris, don't you boil him right. Be sweeter than sugar with every bite. Crawfish.
From Shreveport-Bossier to the heart of Acadiana, springtime crawfish boils attract tourists and locals alike. But when it comes to the art of eating those little mudbugs, it takes a little practice. Native New Orleanian and food writer Scott Gold has spent decades refining his crawfish eating technique. Scott's here to share his thoughts on what he describes as the mystical art of crawfish kung fu.
In my many years as a crawfish lover, I estimate that I'm personally responsible for a small-scale crustacean apocalypse. When I gaze on the hundreds, thousands of discarded crawfish heads, legs, pincers, and empty tails at the end of a long springtime boil, I am reminded of the words of J. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb, who, upon seeing his creation, quoted the Bhagavad Gita saying, "Now I am become death, destroyer of worlds." Live crawfish take one look at my hungry, smiling face and know that the end is nigh. That is how much I love crawfish, and though my karma might suffer for it, I have no shame in saying so. I've always been fond of introducing the joys of the mudbug burl to Yankee neophytes. It's cute the way they take a small plate of hot crawfish and pick at them tentatively, instead of waiting at the crawfish table like an Olympic sprinter in his blocks, coiled and ready to pounce on the next batch of steaming crawfish as soon as they spill out onto the table. I enjoy taking them under my wing and teaching them the various methods of proper crawfish peeling, beginning with the head pull and suck, then the tail peel and pinch. Once they master that, I instruct them, sensei-like, in the mysterious two-handed black belt technique, in which one is able to separate the head, suck it dry, then remove a full meaty tail out of its shell using only one's teeth, sans peeling. A true crawfish ninja can shell, suck, and devour a whole crawfish in a matter of a few short seconds. Crawfish are not fussy food, nor one of any kind of moderation. They are meant to be enjoyed in what the coneheads called mass quantities. Or as I like to say, the only way you know when you've had enough boiled crawfish is when there are no more boiled crawfish. I wasn't always the Bruce Lee of crawfish eating kung fu. Maybe that's overstepping it a little bit. I'm probably more of a crawfish Jean-Claude Van Damme. I didn't realize how much I had to learn about the mystic art and profound science of mudbug mastery until I was a junior in high school, when I was playing on the varsity baseball team. One day, we were called on to play an away game in Port Sulphur, Louisiana, deep into the bayous south of New Orleans and a hearty drive away from home. We got to leave school at noon, which was nice. However, about halfway there, the heavens split and came down on us hard, forcing us to cancel the game, turn around, and start driving home. Our coach wasn't going to drive us all the way out into swamp country for nothing. "Y'all hungry?" he asked. And we said yes, because we were high school athletes with the metabolism of your average hummingbird on amphetamines, so yes, we were constantly hungry. "Good," he said. "I know a decent place for crawfish not far from here." When we arrived at the seafood shack in God knows where, Louisiana, I wasn't quite prepared for what I was about to witness. As the team made our way through the mountain of boiled crawfish at a measured pace, Coach Dozier, seated at the head of a long table like an emperor presiding over his court, Sheldon ate the crustaceans in front of him at a velocity I could scarcely comprehend. His movements were fast but deliberate, with the kind of ease and skill only acquired after years of monastic study and practice. It was a quick 1-2-3 maneuver. Pull off the head, slurp the juices, pluck the tail meat, tick, 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 like a metronome, then repeat, 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 repeat. The author Malcolm Gladwell once posited that it takes 10,000 hours in the pursuit of any activity in order to achieve genuine mastery. My guess is that Coach Dozier had at least double that. Watching him work his way through pile after pile of crawfish was an eye-opener and a game-changer, all in one muggy afternoon somewhere off of Highway 23. When I returned to school just in time to catch the end of algebra class, my fingers numb with spice and my t-shirt graffitied with splashes of pungent crawfish guts, much to the revulsion of my classmates, I knew I had so much left to learn. I might not yet have attained the zen-like perfection in which my baseball coach devoured crawfish, but I'm certainly no hack. There are skills in these fingers. Perhaps one day, with continued study and a gray Fu Manchu mustache reaching down to my belt, I will attain that level. Until then, all that's left to do is practice. Practice, practice, practice.
Native New Orleanian and freelance food writer Scott Gold. Scott shares more of his food wisdom on No Levy's Food Porn Fridays and on Thrillist.com. What is that luscious golden yellow substance inside of every crawfish that makes people want to suck the heads? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come back from this brief break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What's that luscious golden yellow substance inside of every crawfish that makes people want to suck the heads? It's the heptopancreas, a combination of the liver and the pancreas in mammals. In lobsters, it's that green stuff known as tomoli. Yum! Let's debunk the myths. Crawfish fat is actually good for you. It's low in fat, saturated fat, and trans fats too, with a high proportion of omega-3 fatty acids that reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke. And it's the essential ingredient that makes all the difference in an etouffee or a bisque. I'd never buy a bag of peel tails that weren't glistening golden with crawfish fat. One warning, if the fat is included in the pound bag of peel tails, they'll barely have a 4-month shelf life when frozen. It's crawfish season. Just eat as many mud bugs as you possibly can, right now. Where in the world is Jill Benson? The way this roving reporter covers our state, that's anyone's guess. So Jill, where are you taking us today?
Poppy, I'm taking you on a quest for crawfish bisque. Crawfish bisque is a thick, hearty crawfish stew made with a dark roux and our aromatic trinity. And then crawfish heads are cleaned and stuffed with a crawfish dressing and submerged in the stew along with some crawfish tails that have been peeled and cleaned. And it's stuffing those heads that takes such a long time.
So now that we've covered the technique, where in the heck can you find it? Because I know crawfish bisque has almost become extinct.
Well, you can always find it at the Bon Ton Cafe. They have it every day. They make it every day of every year, whether crawfish are in season or out.
And of course, that's located on Magazine Street near Poydras in the CBD of New Orleans.
Yes. And during Lent, you can get it every Friday at Little Dizzy's Cafe over on Esplanade Avenue in the Treme. Wayne Bakke, the proprietor of Little Dizzy's, was telling me that a lady named Tina, who works for him, spends weeks leading up to Jazz Fest stuffing between 8 and 10,000 crawfish heads.
Lord, I wouldn't want that job.
I don't want that job either. I've discovered one other place where you can get crawfish bisque every day during crawfish season. This was a thrilling find for me.
Okay, give it up.
Okay, 4801 General Meyer Avenue in Algiers. There's a little establishment. It's a soul food restaurant called Faye's Restaurant / Honey Whip Donuts. It is now primarily a donut shop. And the donuts are made by Raya Antoine. He makes them every day fresh. He makes buttermilk drops, and they are delicious. And his wife is Miss Faye Antoine. Her grandmother was a domestic worker in New Orleans. Her name was Naomi Williams. And Miss Faye would go to work with her grandmother during crawfish season because the people whom she worked for loved crawfish bisque, and they wanted enough in their freezer to get them through to the beginning of the next crawfish season. I was talking to Miss Faye, and she said that at the beginning of crawfish season, her grandmother would take her with her to work, and they would get 2 sacks of crawfish, and they would go through the entire process, which Miss Faye said took weeks, making all of this crawfish bisque and freezing it for this family. To this day, she enjoys making crawfish bisque, and every week during crawfish season, she makes copious quantities of crawfish bisque to sell at Honey Whip Donuts.
So you can buy it to go. Does she serve it there as well? Is this like a little cafe, or is this just crawfish bisque and donuts to go?
You can eat there. You'll be eating out of a styrofoam container, but there are places where you can sit. And the crawfish bisque is sold for $18.50 a quart. Get on over there to Algiers.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Jill Benson. When was the last time you sat down to a steaming bowl of crawfish bisque? Actually, here's the better question. When was the last time you cooked some? I'm of the opinion that this most elevated of all Louisiana's crawfish dishes is endangered. Why? Because of the intense labor involved in preparing it. If you make your own, by the time you pick up a steaming stuffed head from a bowl of bisque and scoop out that delicious filling, that's the seventh time you've touched that single crawfish head, and that's a lot of work. Luckily, you don't have to go through sacks of wiggling mud bugs yourself, since pounds of peeled tail meat are readily available. But you do need to clean the heads of enough boiled crawfish to serve at least a half dozen stuffed heads per bowl. My basic recipe, which serves about 8 people, requires 4 pounds of boiled crawfish and 3 pounds of tail meat. The boiled crawfish are peeled and used to make stock. The heads have to be scrupulously cleaned before being stuffed. After the stock is simmering and the heads are clean, make a stuffing that combines a roux with bell pepper, onion, and celery, a little thyme, and tomato paste. Add fresh chopped parsley, sliced green onions, and plain breadcrumbs to help bind it all together. Then, for richness, add a stick of melted butter. The bisque is made with a dark roux, seasonings, and enough stock to make a rich gravy. Stuff each cleaned crawfish head, then roll them in flour and lay them on a baking sheet and drizzle them with more melted butter. Bake the heads until they're browned. Add additional crawfish tail meat along with those stuffed heads to the simmering bisque and ladle that bisque over cooked rice and serve it at once. It's hard work, but worth every minute. You can find my crawfish bisque recipe at wwno.org and our LouisianaEatsRadio.com website. I'm Poppy Tooker, and crawfish bisque is my very favorite Louisiana eat. Crawfish boils are a distinctly Louisiana celebration. A smoking barbecue pit gets the party started all across the South. One place where the pit is always smoking is Jim and Nick's Barbecue. This family-operated business now includes more than 30 locations. Jim and Nick's executive chef, Drew Robinson, carefully maintains the cultural heritage and tradition of this emblematic Southern food. We sat down with Drew to hear his thoughts on the cultural significance of barbecue and how the Fatback Collective, a group of barbecue fanatics, keep him inspired.
What has the Fatback Collective done for me? I mean, I like wake up in the morning going, wow, I get to hang out with these people because they're really the, you know, best friends and coolest people and chefs, thinkers, writers, and, you know, somehow in my professional life, I've managed to stumble my way into that. And so, you know, what does it do for me? I mean, it's opened doors to meet people that I never would have thought that I would have a relationship with. It gives me the opportunity to have friends who are sounding boards and thinkers to brainstorm with in ways that I never really thought that I would have done professionally. And it also just, it gives me a great group of friends to have a really good time with.
Well, it's kind of like a bad boys fraternity a little bit, isn't it?
Well,
oh, I mean, tell the truth.
I guess we're on New Orleans radio here, right?
Right.
Yeah, the first time we ever got together was officially at Memphis in May. The idea was, let's see if we can go in here and barbecue a real pig, not, you know, not a commodity hog, but let's see if we can get a heritage animal, barbecue it, just straight up honest cooking and not doctor it up or have any tricks up our sleeves and just serve really honest food and see how that competes. And in the process, yeah, we had smoking jackets, and granted we were in Memphis, but it might have looked like Mardi Gras in our tent, you know. But ultimately, I mean, I think the point really needs to be made and drilled home that, yeah, we like to play, we like to have a good time, and we're all good friends, but at the end of the day, whatever it is that we're coming together on sort of a common ground to do, whether it's Memphis in May or whether it's most recently trying to help a friend of ours rebuild his barbecue pits, you know, the underlying theme at every occasion is that we're trying to take the things that we have to offer, bring them all together, and do good work for whatever the cause at hand is.
Well, I personally feel like you all are doing good work by raising the bar on the pig itself. What do you think Southern barbecue is really all about these days?
I think at its most basic level, it's what it's always been about, which is bringing people together. I mean, I think that, you know, there are barbecue restaurants in every town in the South, you know, whether you're in Birmingham, Alabama, or Memphis, Tennessee, or in its own way, New Orleans or parts of Louisiana. Barbecue exists beyond restaurants, and it's the kind of thing that's there. It's about bringing people together. It's what people do when they have something to celebrate, or maybe sometimes even have something to mourn, but it brings people together. You know, and I think that's the thing that makes Jim and Nick's unique, is that barbecue is a very nostalgic food. It reminds you of a real specific time and place in your life. You know, for me, it reminds me of my grandfather who used to cook ribs, you know, in his backyard, and it reminds me of the restaurants close to home in Birmingham where I grew up eating barbecue. And you know, there's some restaurants in the world you go to where you go in because you know they're going to change the menu every day, and you want that excitement. And there's some restaurants you go to because you know exactly what this pulled pork sandwich is going to taste like and what it reminds you of. And it's the most comfortable, soul-satisfying thing that you can think of. And that's why you go there. And, you know, so I think that's what we try and fulfill for people.
Well, I'm kind of curious, with all the places that there are Jim and Nick's, how come you all have not jumped the border into Louisiana, Mississippi, or Arkansas?
I think that's probably a mixed bag of answers. We've got 33 restaurants now. That keeps us really busy. that's not to say we wouldn't come to Arkansas or Mississippi or Louisiana. It just, you know, the time hasn't really been right for it. You know, I think Louisiana is a different place than Mississippi or Arkansas or Alabama or Georgia. I mean, the culture here is not that there's not a barbecue culture here, but it's a lot different. You know, I don't know of another part of the country that has the uniqueness of culinary culture that Louisiana does. So I think for us to try and import what we do down here, I'll give you an example. We opened a restaurant outside of Memphis, and our ambition wasn't to compete with Memphis barbecue, but just to be a part of the culture. So I think if we ever opened up a restaurant down here, why try and compete with what happens in Louisiana? I mean, we would come down here just because we wanted to be friends and be a part of it.
We wouldn't suddenly find gumbo on the Jim and Nick's menu, you're saying?
We're not trying to make boudin and say we're experts on Louisiana culture by any stretch.
So looking ahead 20 years down the road, do you have any idea what we might be seeing or looking for in Southern barbecue?
20 years down the road, you know, there is what is, and there's what my hope would be. And my hope, you know, I'll give you an example. The past 6 weeks, my friend Rodney Scott has been on what we've called the Rodney in Exile tour, and he's been touring the South, even down here in Louisiana with our friends at Cochon. He barbecued his whole hog. They had a big party, a bunch of folks turned out. He's done this all over the South. And, you know, everywhere it's been a celebration of his style of barbecue, which his family's been doing for 50 years in Hemingway, South Carolina. And, you know, my friend Ryan Pruitt, who is the chef and partner at Pesh, he told me today, he said, you know, I'm amazed that wherever Rodney cooks his barbecue, it's just so damn good, and it always tastes the same. It's incredible. So 20 years from now, I hope that people who steward their pits and, you know, champion old traditions are doing what they're doing today and, you know, fighting the good fight to preserve culture and tradition and ways of life that really matter to us.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for carving a little time into your busy visit to New Orleans to talk with us on Louisiana Eats. Thank you, Drew.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That was Drew Robinson, executive chef of Jim and Nick's Barbecue Restaurant. We'll be right back with award-winning author John T. Edge, who shares his thoughts on how race and Southern barbecue intersect. Stay tuned.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Do you know when that open fire outdoor cooking you're doing is grilling or when it's really barbecue? Barbecue has got to be low and slow. Grilling is hot and fast. With barbecue, the heat source is indirect and there's smoke involved. Barbecue cooking temps range between 180 and 225 degrees. That slow cooking makes inexpensive cuts like pork shoulder and brisket fork tender. With grilling, direct high heat, whether it's coals or propane, at temps as high as 550 degrees, create that delicious outer crust by caramelizing the natural sugars in meat and sealing in those delicious juices. One thing is certain, whether you're grilling or doing a full-on barbecue production, what ends up on the plate are real Louisiana eats. From his boundless knowledge of Southern culture, John T. Edge is also an expert on quintessential American foods. Whether it's donuts or hamburgers, fried chicken or apple pie, John T.'s knowledge about food is always insightful and engaging. Today we're talking with John T. about the contemporary barbecue scene and how this food historically extended across racial lines in the segregated South. The story of barbecue is really an illustrative American tale of food and race. Tell me how you sort of started along that track.
Well, you know, I guess like any good Southern boy, I begin by saying, well, when I was growing up in middle Georgia, I rode my bike to a barbecue joint a half mile from my house, Old Clinton Barbecue. And I love that place, in part because my family had a charger count there and I could go charge a sandwich and an orange crush and a Brunswick stew and not have to pull money out of my own pocket. I love the food there. I still do. But I realized later in life, after I went back to grad school, after I learned to look at my place at the South with open eyes, I learned that I didn't know who cooked that food. I knew the white folk who stood up front and took the money and handed over the sandwiches. But I didn't know who the men were who labored out of sight at the pit. I didn't know who chopped the wood. I didn't know whose labor resulted in that great sandwich. I only knew Miss Coulter, who stood at Old Clinton with this cleaver in her hand, chopping the hams.
Even after the Civil War, often a white man might be credited for his talent at the pits when it was really the labors of that unacknowledged black man, huh?
There were some really poignant dispatches. One was from the Federal Writers Project, a 1937 interview of a former slave named Wesley Jones of Union, South Carolina, who recalled in the antebellum era that he would stay up all night cooking and basting. And he talks about mopping the meat with a soft rag wrapped in a long prong stick. And in later years, he told the story of a couple of lawyers that came to watch him cook. He said he cooked whole hogs and whole goats. And he said, the lawyers like to watch me anoint that meat. And that, to me, is at the heart of this. You know, there is a reluctant admiration and a reluctant acknowledgement of that former slave's work by these presumably middle class or upper class lawyers. But that's rare, you know, this idea that they thought he had a talent for cooking. It's rare in the historical record that we see whites acknowledging the work of blacks.
Well, one of the things that I found very illuminating was how barbecue began to be a way out of poverty for African Americans.
cooking barbecue by the roadside in an earthen pit was a path towards self-sufficiency for black men and, to a lesser degree, black women. You know, there are tale upon tale of digging a pit, chopping down trees, making, you know, ad hoc charcoal, and in essence, using your wit and using your muscle by the side of the road to earn a living and leveraging that into a small business. And from there, opening another business. You know, there are people like Lawrence Craig, who was a famous barbecue cook in Devall's Bluff, Arkansas. His restaurant still exists in that small town. And Mr. Craig talks about starting on the side of the road with nothing more than an earthenware pit and a piece of corrugated tin to slap on top of it and selling sandwiches and starting that way and then working and working and working until he owned his own business.
James Jones of Arkansas's Jones Barbecue Diner is another great example of that.
Yeah, Mr. Jones, whose place in Marianna, Arkansas, in the Arkansas Delta, may be the oldest black-owned family restaurant in America, if a firm date could be established. It's probably between 1900 and 1910 and is in its third generation and going strong. But his grandfather said they called his place the hole in the wall, and that's just what it was, a window in a wall from which they sold meat that was piled up in a wash tub. And from those beginnings, that family, generation after generation, has made a living and has created this space in Marianna, a town hit hard by poverty, that is, from my travels, the bright light in that town. You know, the reason one would detour off the interstate for Marianna, you know, is solely that barbecue restaurant. And it's a place where you see black and white making pilgrimages. You see rich and poor making pilgrimages. You know, and they value the labor of that family, of the Jones family. And to me, that's one of the few arenas in which black and white often show respect. And they show respect across the dinner table. They show respect across the counter at barbecue restaurants. And Jones is one of those great places where that happens.
Well, the world of barbecue is having a bit of an evolution now, isn't it?
It is. I think right now barbecue is hip. There are at least three shows on the various food networks and travel networks that celebrate barbecue. And yet that, to me, is problematic because most of the attention that the popular press and especially the various cooking and food network shows, they're focusing upon the competition circuit, wherein middle-class white guys like me are the focal point, the kind of person that instead of buying a bass boat, they decided to buy some jerry-rigged cooking apparatus. And they're the people that are now defining excellence in barbecue. They win a trophy and they are celebrated. This is something I argue about fairly often with a good friend, a guy named Brett Martin. And, you know, Brett says that all boats rise by way of this attention on these competition pitmasters. But I think we're losing this great opportunity wherein these aged pitmasters in their 60s, 70s, 80s, they may finally get their due. They may finally get their moment to kind of step to the proscenium when America's paying attention to barbecue. And instead, the camera turns on these middle-class guys for whom barbecue is a hobby, for whom barbecue is an avocation, not a vocation. And I think that's wrong-headed.
So I'm very curious, in all your barbecue research, how do you feel about barbecue chains?
It's a really complicated question, Poppy. I think the best of the barbecue chains, or, you know, multi-unit locations, or whatever phrase you want to use, the best of those are students of that culture and don't attempt to rip it off. Don't attempt to merely acknowledge and riff on it, but study it. And I think they raise awareness of working class cooks. I think there's something different in what those like Danny Meyer and the Union Square Hospitality Group, who own Blue Smoke Restaurant, own multiple Shake Shack restaurants across the country, own a number of white tablecloth restaurants in New York City. Each year they stage something called the Big Apple Barbecue Block Party, and I've gone to that for the last 7 or 8 years. They each year invest in barbecue by way of commissioning a film from us that we make that documents some barbecue culture that's not transportable to New York City. It's too fragile. And they don't claim to cook authentic barbecue as one might find in the American South. They claim to tell a story of barbecue in New York City. And I think you could argue that what Blue Smoke does really began this kind of barbecue renaissance in New York City, where you see, you know, 10 or 12 places that are paying homage to barbecue that don't attempt to say we're as authentic as what you find in Hill Country of Texas or in Central Tennessee, but interpret those foods and pay homage to those cooks. I remember going in Blue Smoke and seeing Frank Stewart's photographs all over the wall from Lola's Eli's book, Smokestack Lightning. And that cue told me they were paying attention to the culture. They were paying homage to the pitmasters. And I think that's honorable if you're honest about it. I think the kind of chain restaurants that install a Southern Pride smoker back behind a strip mall storefront and blow smoke into the street as a means of trying to broadcast they're the real thing, that's a conceit that I can't stomach. But people that interpret barbecue and do so honestly, I think that's great.
Do you ever eat barbecue in Louisiana?
Yeah. There's a great place called Grayson's up, way up, around Natchitoches.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going there because they had both pork and beef on the pit, and at least the time I went, the pork was situated in such a way that it dripped onto the beef and flavored the beef, which I thought was a condemnation of the beef. But I also remembered that they served their barbecue on what they call frog buns, which was their way of saying French rolls.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And the place was genuinely good. When people decry barbecue in Louisiana, I point that place out. And I found other good places back when I was wandering about in Shreveport. There was a place called, I think it was Blue Moon. Mm-hmm. They had great ribs. I mean, barbecue in Louisiana, good barbecue in Louisiana are not mutually exclusive terms.
Are you trying to tell me that the closer you get to Arkansas and Louisiana, the better the barbecue gets?
Oh, you said that, Poppy.
John T., thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for asking me.
John T. Edge, food writer and barbecue fanatic.
Hot barbecue!
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.